you're the first person that I've ever heard of in my entire life that did time, and now, and I was super proud to say that you were a warden.
Started from the
I'm
bottom,
not going to change it. I'm still going to call you Warden King.
Look, and listen, I don't get messed up with that, because basically either
you're going to be.
Well, either the inmate said or staff said, because it down here, if I was here in Louisiana,
you'd
that's
be a warden.
That's what it'd be.
Yeah, you'd be like Warden Cook.
Yeah, that's what it'd be.
Yeah, so you're a warden. Yeah, I don't care what they say in Mississippi. They just got things messed up.
I can remember being assigned to the West Yard in Angola to the craziest dome. And my first day in there.
What dome was it?
It was Pine 2. Mm-hmm. And so I'm on the phone talking. And next thing I know, I see a dude say, "Man, you a rat." And the next thing, they jumped the guy. Three ladies just sitting there, paralyzed. She not moving. And so as soon as they went to jumping him, somehow, I guess they was making rounds, so they opened the door. They broke out running. Guess who's luck just standing right there? It's me. My first day in the dome, I just got a sign.
How old were you?
I probably was about, I want to say about 26 mm-hmm. at that time. I'm sitting there like, man, these people move me in this dome to be assigned as an MA minister at that time. Mm-hmm. And this dude is sitting there. Now, you know I didn't have nothing to do. He's looking at me, the free woman looking, the man said, "Where they at?" Because they knew it was more than one person. And so everybody else is on their bed, right? I'm on the phone. The dude is right there. And so, you know, it's either two things about to happen in this situation, man. I'm going to have to just take a lick and go to the cell block. But it was hilarious because I went to straight into chaos. It was already a chaotic unit, but that happened. And the guy didn't want to say nothing. The free woman, she was like, you the Sarge. You know, in this situation, you even scared? I don't need to be in here. You know, in my mind, I'm on the phone like, look, if I get locked up, y'all had to call up here because I was on the phone the whole time. You right. know, but they didn't do it. They left. They couldn't find the guys who was jumping on the guy, moved them out. And I was just like, man, what kind of hell they didn't put me in, you know? Pine too, man.
So you got blessed your first day in the dormitory.
First day in the dormitory. And listen, I understood from that moment that, listen, this is the worst dome in the penitentiary right here. All things go on. They had a whole bunch of incidents in that dome that probably won't be spoke on. That was one of them, like my first day in there. Like, man, is you serious? Baptize you right there.
Yeah, your accelerated learning session there.
Kiana was telling a story the other day about the cell blocks, but it's the ones, I forget what they call them. They got like, you go into a room and then you go into your cell. What are those called?
Are you talking about extended lockdown?
Well, extended, but like, you know, can you visualize the room in the room that they put you in?
You're talking about Camp Jake.
Camp Jake. Yeah. So he said that dudes are breaking through the walls.
Yeah, they got some.
And jugging people up.
They do more than that. They got some other stuff that go on, you know.
Some of that weird stuff or what?
Oh, man.
Man.
Everything back there is weird, in my opinion. You know, it's weird. Anytime a man hold his feces for 2 months.
And then
just to throw it on you.
What about the darts?
Yeah, it's the baddest darts. That's what I'm telling you. They got so much talent in prison. Because you got guys that make darts that can actually go and stick through a wall. So, you know, how you doing that? If it's made out of paper.
But they dip it in their feces.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of them carry diseases, right? Certain STDs and things like that. They'll dip it in their contaminated feces, and they'll use blow darts. They hit the guards. They hit the dudes who they're beefing with. Boom. Like freaking natives.
With a pen?
No. Tell them, George.
It's all that's a hard one to imagine. So, talking about Camp G. When you graduate seminary, a lot of times they put you in a just put you in a situation to see if you gonna really want to be a minister. Right. So
that's the place to be a minister.
So one day I was 2 weeks in to kind of doing my what they call internship. So they take you on a bus and they bring you to Camp J, and you had to go on the tier and you minister to guys. And so man, I had been on this tier for like a week and a half, passing the same guys, talking to them. And so one day I get on there, guy said, I forgot the name. He said. B, you know I know you from 1978. Come here, you been mine. So I'm sitting like
talking to you.
Yeah, so I'm sitting 1978, man. I was at my house. So I'm not the punk that you talking about. Not me. I'm not a punk, man.
He was
so serious. No, that's what they do. He was so serious, man. They in camp. Just all they do is jokes all day long. They gonna crack jokes. They gonna see
bar fight.
They gonna see what you gonna do. And so I'm talking. I said, man, I'm just coming here, man. Just to give you a word, man, to see how you doing. He said, no, B. You know me. No, I've been looking for you. I've been having you since 1978. So I'm just standing looking at the dude like, bro. First of all, man, I'm 26 years old. You talking about 1978? This don't even make no sense. And I was hot. I'm talking about I was so mad.
Because he didn't cross the boundary, though. Yeah, and you're walking the tightrope of Christianity.
Yeah, I'm trying, to do it respectful. Like, look, hold up. You realize you actually calling me a homosexual. You know what right. I'm saying? In my mind, like, man, I backed up. And I can't do you nothing because I'm really sitting there saying, well, yeah. It's nothing I can do. You in the cell, you know, and we got, it's like three of us who on the tier making rounds. And everybody else is laughing, you know, because the dude is so serious with his episode. Like, man, you know I know you. Y'all know y'all walking with that punk. I'm sitting there like, man, 1978, man. They ain't got nobody that's on this tier with
do
me.
Do the math. Do the math.
Come on, man. It's impossible for me to be the person that you talking about. But that's the kind of stuff that you went through back then. Man, it was crazy. I mean, if you had a mental breakdown, that's the worst place to have it.
Right.
You know, and so you sitting there, you trying to just say, you know what, like you said, I'm caught in that thread. Like, look, I'm an inmate minister, and you didn't, you know, as far as prison rule, you actually violated me, man.
Yeah.
You didn't basically told dudes, I'm your punk, you know.
Right.
And so.
What's that song? It says, don't play with me, play with Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a shirt that said.
Saved, not.
No, I don't know if you've seen that shirt. It said, pray with me.
Don't play with me. That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
You know, we're all still in here for a reason.
Yeah.
I had a shirt, man, but it happens, man. It happens to the best of them, you know.
Yep. All right, well, this is Scott with P2P Podcast, Penitentiaries to Penthouses. On my left is your best friend in real estate.
Shout out.
Scott. To the right of me is Mr. George King. George, you live in Slidell?
No, I stay in LaPlace.
LaPlace, okay. Yeah. LaPlace. Yeah. LaPlace. If you got the accent, it's LaPlace. Right. If you right. If you're a redneck out of Livingston Parish, it's LaPlace.
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 But no, George was in the same facility I was at Rayburn Correctional Center. He was a traveling minister, man. I tell people all the time, some of the people that impacted me the most when I was incarcerated were these guys that went through the seminary. They transfer them to different prisons and use them as ministers, set up churches, all kinds of stuff. George was, you helped set up the church at Rayburn, didn't you?
No, I didn't help set up. I actually, when I came there, I think Arthur Rose and Pastor Jackson, they had already been there, so they already it was already rolling. But I was at Rayburn. I started my time there.
When
it was
right, and then you went to Angola for the seminary. That's right. Yeah, I remember now. But so I want to touch on real quick what you're doing right now, and then we're gonna rewind a little bit and talk about what led you to prison, short synopsis of that. We'll talk about your incarceration and then some of the challenges you face when you come home, and then all the great things you do now. We'll focus more on that. But you right now you're working for the Mississippi Department of Corrections.
Yes, sir.
And are you a warden?
So that's what everybody, that's the whole fight. Everybody calls me.
Well, everybody been telling me that.
Yeah, that's what everybody say. So in Mississippi, they didn't have a program warden. They actually trying to develop that.
Like they do in Louisiana.
Yeah, so what they call them is directors. So you'll have people say Warden King, or they'll say the director of programs. And so what I am right now, I'm the director of all programs at the institution.
Okay.
And so, but it don't, you know, you got so many people. That's what they say.
Well, I'm so proud because, and I've been, I guess I've probably, contributed to that. But like I've said for years, the only way the Department of Corrections is actually going to change and do its job by being a rehabilitative is when you put people who are formerly incarcerated in positions of power and run the prison.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. And you're the first person that I've ever heard of in my entire life that did time, and now, and I was super proud to say that you were a warden.
Started from the
I'm
bottom,
not going to change
here.
It. I'm still going to call you Warden King.
Look, and listen, I don't get messed up with that because basically either
you're going to be.
Well, either the inmates say or staff say it because it down here, if I was here in Louisiana,
you'd
that's
be a warden.
That's what it would be.
Yeah, you'd be like Warden Cook.
Yeah, that's what it'll be.
Yeah, so you're a warden. Yeah, I don't care what they say in Mississippi. They just got things messed up. But Yeah, man, I'm super happy to hear that. And I think with that, are you the first person in the country to do this?
Me and Ron Olivia, as far as what the job I'm doing?
Yeah, like, yeah. I know in Mississippi for sure, but, like, nationally.
Yes, sir.
I don't know anybody else.
Nah, we actually was the first chaplains that they ever had.
They messed up.
Right, and so now I come out of the chaplain department, and now I'm over all the programs. And actually, if you would see how it works, like, even right now, all the stuff that being instituted in Mississippi for change, mm-hmm. my hands are all on it.
That's
so it's kind of
that's awesome.
It's amazing, man. Well, things that are going taking place in Mississippi.
We're going to talk about that more. But if you don't mind, can you just tell us a little bit about where you're from and kind of your story and what led you to prison? And then we'll talk about the incarceration part in a second.
So I'm from the West Bank. Most people don't know what that is.
Is it the best bank?
Best bank.
Okay.
When I say that because I'm out of state, everywhere on the West Bank, from the Fisher Project all the way to Avondale.
Algiers,
everywhere,
Marrero.
Everywhere.
I used to listen to the 9 o'clock props.
That's it right there.
Q9 to the 3. Oh, yeah. 9 o'clock props is on. And they're always calling in from the West Bank.
Always.
Always.
And so from the West Bank, man, I had this moment just thinking about that. I love the West Bank, stayed there probably my whole life. I never went anywhere else. And I was involved in the drug trade. And so, when the shortest stint I can tell you about is when you live in that type of lifestyle, things happen. You know, yeah. During the time when I was selling drugs, was probably New Orleans was the most violent city in America.
90s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Shout out 90s NOLA.
Yeah. So I'm one of those 90s kids. So during that time, you know, when you're dealing with that type of business, things happen. So my charge happened between a friend and I. Mm-hmm. He robbed me and I killed him. Mm-hmm. And so I actually went to court, was charged with first degree murder and 4.5 ounces of crack cocaine. Went to trial, got found guilty of 25 years for manslaughter and ended up at WCI. And so that place.
When it was WCI, right?
Yeah, I ended up there when we had to have hunger strikes, had to do everything you could do. This is a vibe there. I remember they didn't even have, when I was there, they didn't even have, you know, you went to the walk, they didn't have no fences there. And so guys were literally robbing guys when I first got there.
They
put the hood
on. They robbing you with the walks.
Well, I'm talking about you had to go to the canteen. You had to walk to the canteen from Winyard all the way to the front where they got the pill call at right now.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was a long, scary walk. If you just dumped into a situation, it's, I always think about prison. Guys on the street, it's easy for them to adapt because you're living in danger all the time. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't, you get to a place like WCI or one of the other camps that they call gladiator camps, you'll be shook up. You know, it's like, hold up where I'm at. You got guys walking around with hoodies, fighting some of the guys, choking guys out. And so I got there and was almost like, man, I'm back on the streets. You know, it's the same thing that was going on.
So WCI is basically like a whole
Washington
cell?
Correctional Institute, but now it is RCC, Rayburn Correctional Center. Okay. It was named after a warden, BB-60 Rayburn.
Yeah, I don't know where they get that fooling.
Yeah, I don't know. Some legend in Washington Parish, apparently. But, yeah, so it was WCI, and they just changed the name.
Yeah. They changed the name probably about, I want to say 2007, something like mm-hmm. that, somewhere around that time.
So, You adapted pretty quickly to the environment at Rayburn?
I won't say adapted, because one thing I didn't adapt to, I never wanted to just acknowledge I was in prison. You know, the whole while I was in there, I was just like, man, ain't no way in the world. I could just, you know, prison just didn't fit me. And when I got there, I understood because it was, you know, this was a prison, but it was stuff that was going on that probably other people were like, man, I can't make it here. You know, I'll never forget one guy that rode the bus with me. He got there and literally his whole body was shaking because he was really nervous for the stuff that was going on at the time. Because at that time, WCI, man, they had to get bikes, you know. They probably still, because guys will fight, like right now it's hot.
Oh, they still
they
ride bikes.
All day long. Something happens every second just about, you know, at that time. So that part, you know, I never got adjusted to taking a shower with somebody. You know, sitting on the toilet and the dude comes sit next to you, want to talk. Man, I'm taking a dump, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so all that stuff I couldn't adapt to that. It was just the fact that the violence didn't bother me at the time. You know, it just was a part of life. That's just something you grew up in. But the prison itself, having to go inside at a certain time, being told when you go eat, when you can't eat. You
dealing know, with hateful guards.
Oh, yeah. Now, that was my first encounter, and I say this, with racism.
With true racism? Oh, yeah. How old were you?
I had to be on, I went to WCI about 22. So, man, I'm talking about when I first got there, you know, I grew up around white people, but I never had somebody actually display racism. I heard about
white people on the West Bank are pretty different.
Well, in New Orleans,
Peter, yeah,
you know, it's a little different.
You got guys named Popeye down there.
Yeah, oh man, I'm talking about Popeye.
Shout out Popeye.
You know Popeye?
No.
Oh.
I always see the video. And
yeah,
start
yeah,
laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
But
he got the glow sticks with the yad.
Yeah, with the yad of the yad. but it was a straight encounter. I ain't talking about sideways. I mean, when I got there, man, we had to go in the field. And when you get out there, man, these people are literally picking on you, handcuffing you, and kicking your face. And
on wanna, horses.
Yeah. Look, I'll never forget my second week that I told my mom, I said, look, I said, I'm going to come out the same way I came in. And I said that, and I can't promise that to you because these people are literally attacking.
Pushing you, yeah.
And so I was there, and I wound up getting in the cell blocks. I forgot what it was for. But I was there, we went in the field, and they had been doing this at a rapid pace. They handcuff you, and they'll actually kick you in your face. You'll be on your knees, they'll kick you. So one day I'm working, you know, and that's not all the time. But this time I actually was in the field working. You know, like, man, I'm trying to get out this field. I've been there in the field all the time. So, like, man, I'm trying to get out this field and do something different.
Get a drop.
Something, man. This field is not working.
A drop is a job.
It's a job. Look, he about to ask that question. Yep. He told me, like, what is a drop?
I should have let you ask him. Well, that's all right. Yeah, yeah.
So you were about to get caught in the field. You were just working, trying to get that drop.
And so one of the sergeants that was known for doing that, he came and said, hey, give me your ID. And so when they do you that, hey, they're going to either write you up or you're about to get locked up. And so I gave him my ID. And I'm like, for what? See, I'm about to lock you up. And so the sergeant that ran the line came over and was like, what's going on? And so he's like, man, he wasn't working. So I said, man, you seen me working. The sergeant who ran the line was named Sergeant Harry. Everybody, I don't know if you remember him.
Who is it?
Sergeant Harry. Tall, always talking loud. He loved Alabama. That's what he, that was his team.
Yeah, I think I know who you're
and
talking
so,
about.
So Sergeant Harry at the time, people would pick on the cell kind of stuff. But he knew I was working. And so now he in the conflict. He knew what was about to go on. I told the guy, look, man, I'm not about to let you lock me up. And so he pulled his handcuffs. I said, nope, that's not about to happen. I'm not putting the handcuffs on. So now they got to call. When there's something like that happen, they're going to call everybody.
We need backup on the west
so
field.
That's what they're going to do. So we was in a field right next to the cell block. I said, look, I'm not letting you put the handcuffs on me. I'll walk over there. So they called the captain out. Captain come out. And it's funny, the captain wound up being a ward. So at this time, he was the field captain.
Which one, Bickham?
Bickham. So Bickham comes out. He's like, what you mean you ain't going to let him put you? I said, man, look. This, I'm not saying y'all can't lock me up. I'm not letting him put my handcuffs on me because I know what he do. We the cell block right there. We can walk over there. And so after a while, I guess they huddled up and said, well, it ain't worth it because I'm just positioned, just standing there like, look, this ain't about to go down like that. You're not putting the handcuffs on me. We're going to go in on the fight because I realize this is what you've been doing.
Yeah. So, well, you might as well get it in because you know they're going to beat your ass
anyway.
If
you go kick me in my face, look, that's what's about to happen, and yeah. I ain't doing it. So we went all the way to the cell block. He walked me to the cell block, just me and Bickham. He like, he said, so you basically was ready to have a standoff. I said, man, I'm basically ready to make sure I go home not hurt by one of y'all. I didn't come here. My crime wasn't committed by nobody yet. Yeah. So I'm not about to let you put your hands on me. So I went to the cell block, man, and got back there. It's like, Lord have mercy, Jesus. This is a whole nother situation.
Well, how did it feel whenever you were like in the standoff? Though, was it like, oh shit, it's about to happen? You know, like, is there like a certain amount of, because like,
you never know. You know,
in?
You never know. That's all it is. You ain't operating off of none of that. You ain't sitting there saying, I want this performance. No, this I'm hyping myself and saying I'm gonna carry this through because I'm not gonna let you just.
But I'm gonna tell you, when you make a stand like that, though. As much as they might want to beat your ass at the moment,
yeah.
Moving forward, did they respect you more?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Because they're so used to people cowering down, that's what they want.
And get a kick in the face, cower down.
But whenever you got a set of nuts and you're willing to take pride in yourself and you know right from wrong and you can call them out on that,
yeah.
Moving forward, you're good.
And that's basically what happened. Like, during that time at WCI, It was several of us that went through a hard season that we had to stand up against them because, man, people was dying.
Yeah.
Like, you had some guys going to hospital every day for something. The food was bad. They used to give us this meat And I think they disbanded. It's called Vitapool. You can put a little water on the beet be this small. By the time you put that water on it, the meat like this.
Yeah, right? like the little dinosaur.
So we had to go on a hunger strike. So you had the guys at that time, you know, it was a little different. And I think about time now versus time then. You had some guys that just was like that. This is going to let you do anything. So most of the guys who was at that prison, they wasn't going to just allow anything to happen. And so, you know, that's the era I came into prison, you know, from off the street. So WCI was it was a blessing and a curse, you know, to go there.
They escorted you to where were they taking you before?
Talking about the cell block?
Yeah.
Yes, they escorted me to the cell block. You're going to go to lockdown. I stayed there for Sun Union. That's what it was. Sun Union, I stayed there for about probably 2 days.
It's
to court.
It's miserable back there.
Oh yeah. That's the other side of prison that, you know.
Prison within a prison.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So you go in prison. Now you're in another prison because you're going to cell block. So I wound up going to the welcome cell block, and you spend a lot of time. It's going to be you and another individual. And so sometimes you don't have nobody in the cell. Just you by yourself. You got time to actually think. And I think that was my moment. You know, I think about moments that I was in prison, moments to actually transfer. I came to prison mainly because I had an educational problem, you know. And in my mind, even when I was on society, the reason why I hustled because I realized, hey, I'm not like everybody else, you know. I ain't going to finish high school. So I was selling drugs, some people say, oh, I'm selling drugs to feed my family. But in my mind, this is the way I was going to make it. Mm-hmm. And so, but I never dealt with the issue of education. I always was told, hey, man, you'll never be able to read. So I could have probably changed on the street, but that was a moment for me, a God moment, to go in the cell blocks, right? So I got in the cell blocks, sat there and started thinking about, hey, man, you in this prison. You know, you got 25 years. And so while I was in there, it's like, man, I got to start reading, trying to do something, man. So getting a little help. And one of my biggest issues I had, I didn't want to tell nobody I didn't know how to read because you're in prison, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to read. That's a hard thing. And if guys been around me, you know, they know I like to play. So that's a weapon, you know. That's especially if you tell a guy like me, you can't read. So I'm a juice off y'all day.
Why you can't read?
You big stupid dummy. Tell me what that say. You know, that's it. But
yeah,
it's stuff like that. We juicing, you know. So I knew I was one of them dudes, so I would joke about everything. So
joking also means like just joking. Picking on people, joking, cutting up, things like that.
And so that's what that means. Cause you asked the question, man. I thought you said you gonna be asking the questions, man.
Nah, he's just
slacking on your pants.
Nah, man.
Did I just take it over?
We finished each other's.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You know what I'm
saying? Anyway, so while I was like this, going through this mindset, man, I gotta get myself together. I wound up standing up blocks almost 2 years trying to get myself together, and 2 years is a long damn time in the cell. And so I got out, and today I got out, it was a guy named Mario and John Sheehan had just come to the prison for Mango.
Oh,
John, man. John.
Is he coming home?
Man, hope so. Hope so. I just seen John. So
miss you, John.
John's a...
You miss John?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know him? You just
Shout out John.
Shout out, he's listening somewhere.
So John is a unique dude, and Mario Howe is a unique dude. I don't know if you ever met Mario. Mm-hmm. So these two guys was one of the first two missionaries sent from Angola. And so they come in the dormitory, they start talking about a program called Spiritual Growth Faith-Based Program. And the first thing I heard him say was, it's going to help you to make parole. So that's all I heard. I ain't had nothing else. All right. So I get up there, I sign up, and just listen to the dude. Like, man, they ain't never had these type of dudes. First of all, ain't no dude walking in no dormitory at WCI at the time when I was, well, you know, this didn't happen. These guys had access to move around. And so the guy come, he said, man, sign this paperwork here. You're going to be in the class. I get in the class. First thing they tell you, you got to do a workbook. I can't read.
Damn.
So I ain't never asked. The only thing I ever did when you first come to prison, they give you a TABE test, right? So my TABE test, I scored so low, the people said, like, they ain't had nothing else for me to do, right? Because at the time, Warren Cook was in there,
yeah,
right? So they didn't have no special education. They ain't had none of those things. So they had some education, but not like he had. That boy had school everywhere. I don't know if you ever seen how crazy he was. He put school in the gym.
I know.
In the kitchen, everywhere you could think.
Every nook and cranny in the prison had some type of class, some type of program, something.
Yeah, and so I always tell people, man, sensitive years, he wound up being my mentor because he believed in two things. He didn't just believe the teacher person about religion, about God, but he also wanted you to be educated. You know,
Warden Cook?
Oh, yeah, that was his thing. Look, if you was a preacher and you didn't have education, he didn't really want to talk to you. He going to force you to say, okay, I want you not only to say that you know God, but I want you to have an educated mind that you're always thinking, that your people need to be thinking. So he put school everywhere. And so he sent them guys down there. And, man, I'm talking about when he got there, if you had a 2.6 on your tape or something like that, you was going to school. That was his thing. So
you was in the pre-GED class?
Oh, yeah, that's what you're going to be. So, like, right then and there, he ain't playing with you. He ain't making you sign up. So I signed the paper to get in the faith base. They put me in faith base in the pre-GED class, right? So now I'm in my first time. Like, look, first of all, I'm coming out the blocks. I'm supposed to go in the field. No, you going to pre-GED. That's what you're doing. And so they had all this stuff set up. And so I was getting there. People still don't know how to read, right? And so the night it happened was, it was my day to read a chapter in the book, right? So I got the book, opened the chapter up. I ain't reading that, right? So, dude, what you mean you ain't reading that? So you know what? It's a small group. Hey, it's out there. I can't read. So I tell it to the guy, not looking for the response he gave. Mario says to me, he said, listen, never say that in my classroom again. But he don't say it, you know, all soft. He said it real aggressive. And he said, man, nothing is impossible for God. So I was looking at him, man, that dude got to be crazy as all outdoors. So I took the book, thought about what he said. Class kept going. Dude was like, man, we're going to help you out.
Who was your tutor in there?
So, no, this is in the faith-based class.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
So, there's a tutor in the class.
Yeah.
All in Dunn. I don't know if you remember AD. I don't know if you remember him.
I don't think I remember.
But he's from Covenant, right? So, he's in the class. He wound up being one of the best tutors ever had. So, it's all in Dunn. You know Chill? I don't know if you know Chill.
Yeah.
But Chill, all of us in the class, right? So, them guys start talking to me, like, man, we're going to help you out. So, me all in Dunn, every day. Not AD. What's his name is? I think it's all in Dunn. But every day he'll come get me, him and John. Come get me. John will read Proverbs every day. And so I got my GED in 6 months, man.
You learned how to read in 6 months?
Yeah, the part I'm not going to skip over is the part I know some of y'all, I don't know how many people that came, sat in this chair and start talking about God. But this the part that I think changed my life.
I like it. Come on with it.
So after that encounter, it was made on November, I think it was November the 4th, because November the 5th, I goes to the dormitory. I'm sitting there thinking about everything that everybody said. Because in that class, it was a spiritual moment that got it, for me, it wasn't spiritual. For the people that was there, when I released that I couldn't read, it turned into a spiritual moment, not something somebody joking about. That them guys were saying, man, don't never say that again. Man, it's nothing impossible for God. So they kept on saying that. So I get back to the dormitory. I'm sitting there thinking about the whole environment. Like, man, I done told these guys this, and they didn't. It's like
they didn't even make fun of me.
They didn't make fun of me, but they went somewhere else with it.
Yeah.
So I'm just sitting there thinking about it, and like the dome just froze, right? Everybody in the dome was like, just stop still, no movement. And it's a picture. Like, I'm looking at everybody, the people standing in the dome. It's a picture. I'm looking into my life, and God is showing me, you know, hey, I'm the same God kept you all those years. So the issue is, you know, God was showing me the times when I could have been killed, I got shot at, you know, when God shot my car, when I went to prison when I was 16, I could have stayed in prison for a murder I was on at the time. He was the one, even though, you know, we think you slick, that no, God was with me, you know what I'm saying? Because I could have did my time right there.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept showing me, look, all those times, that was me trying to give you opportunity. It's me again. Don't pass this opportunity up. And so, like, it was that direct. I'm sitting on the bed like, pass this opportunity up. It's me again. Next thing you know, I see myself when I was a little kid in the church. And when I went to church, it was my favorite thing I do in church. Go to sleep. And I realize when the preacher's about to end the sermon, that's when I'm up. I act like I did everything right in church. I'm up listening. And at that time, the only thing that happens in any Baptist church, the preacher's going to be talking about when Jesus is about to rise, right? On the third day, that's what they do. You know, most Baptist churches, they're going to get to that point.
Yeah.
They're going to hoop, they're going to get excited, and they're going to talk about the resurrection. Well,
resurrection.
Yeah, say it right for me this morning. Lord have mercy. I'm trying to make fun of the people, but that's what they're going to be talking about. You know, Jesus has risen. That's the scene that I end with, and I'm sitting on the bed like, man, what in the world is going on? I go to sleep. I say, man, I think it's time for me to get my life together. So I get up. Never forget this, man. I still was selling weed in prison. I said, man, I can't sell weed and be a Christian.
Yeah.
That can't happen. And so I remember going to a guy. And so instead of me just saying, look, just take this right here, and I'm done. So I give him the weed, and I say, hold that for me, man. Take care of that, and I'll get back with you. And so I'm going to these classes, and the dude just like, hey, man, you're trying to get your life together, and look like you're trying to, you know, trying to be a religious dude. You can't be having me get selling no weed for you. And so I just looked at him. I said, bro, you know what? You're right. You can have it. And so I wound up going to the guy and said, man, I want y'all to I know how to do it. Lead me to the way of salvation. Boom, Mary, you and John, right there. So I confess the Lord saved, the Lord Jesus is my Savior. And man, I started from right there. I said, you know what? I'm gonna serve God just the same way I was living wild out there. I'm gonna be sold out. And so, man, I just started from right there at WCI and said, I'm gonna get my life together. I got my GED. So that's why I go back to the GED. Because I know that the only reason why I got my GED is by the grace of God. Because in reality, how you take a guy that couldn't read, couldn't write, and never went to fundamental school, like talking about, I was always in special ed, and then 6 months, right, and get his GED. And so during that time, I know, even though I had help, I knew it was the grace of God. His presence was in my life. And so I told Mario, I said, look, man, I said, I need you and John to help me. I want to go to seminary. I want to go to college, right? And so I told him, I said, man, my father's side of the family is nothing but corruption. And I said, man, I don't have that. I'm going to do something better for my son because I had a kid. And so I said, I want to go to college, right? So I told him, he called Warden Cook. Called this joker. The joker told me, he said, man, no way in the world you going to college, man. It's not going to happen. He said, you don't have enough time. Angola's not going to accept you. So I said to him, I said, here it is. You're supposed to be the chaplain. Your minister said nothing impossible for God. I just got my GED. He stops in the middle of his sentence because that's where he was going with that. He said, let me check into 2 weeks later, he called me up there. He said, man, they're going to accept you. He said, but you got to convince 5 more people. I said, man, is you crazy? I can't convince 5 other people. I just had to convince my family that I'm about to go to Angola. You telling me to tell 5 dudes that they got to go to Angola with me? No, that is not about to happen. He said, well, that's the only way you can go. So I left. I said, all right, it's on me now. I went down there, and my evangelism at that time, my first sermons, I need you, brother, and the Lord needs you to go to Angola. So my evangelism at that time, I'm at the fence.
You found you some disciples.
Yeah, I had to find some disciples, man, to go with me. So I found 5 guys.
Who'd you bring?
Ralph Williams, Sharif, he was a Muslim brother.
Yeah.
Who else came with me, man? Charles, I don't know if you know Charles. His name is Boston. You probably seen, have you ever seen the hospice video?
Yeah, got a guy on there
called Charles Rogers.
Yeah.
I got him. Who else came with us? So Mario came back. He was one of the guys came back, and myself. And one other guy. Man, let me see. It's crazy. I know Charles Rogers, Ralph Williams, Shahid, Mario, myself. That's 5.
Okay.
And so we all left, right? Get to Angola, start seminary, and just had a brain freeze as soon as I got there and forgot. Like, man, none of this stuff makes sense. And I'm like, man, I ain't the way in the world I'm finna school. And so, because it was real.
Tell them, tell the people out there what the seminary is. It's a 4-year college program.
Yeah, 4-year accredited, just like who LSU.
Who is the college?
New Orleans Theological Baptist Seminary.
All right. I just wanted the people to know it ain't no middle of the mall school. It's
like Angola U.
Yeah, it's legit.
They got them out there.
An accredited college.
So that's what makes it tough. You know, a lot of guys, they hear a college in prison, they think, oh man, it's gonna be an easy skate. No, indeed. My God, in that thing, man, they had words this long. And I know I'm talking about the words that you just, man, what the hell? I ain't never heard that before. Mm-hmm. And so I get there, and it's like the same principle when I was in the GED, is that God was there with me, all right? I prayed the whole while, and so now I'm in a different environment, right? So now I'm in an environment where I'm around all the guys who I grew up with, you know, who was doing stupid stuff, and I'm here now as a Christian. And so it's a little different because I didn't come there, you know, so it's like, all right, it's a little different place. And so now it's a test of your character, because one of the things about, and you know this, Scott, is when a guy sees a Christian in prison, you watched all day, right? Because they want to see if you have any resemblance of a person that's not a believer. It's easy to be a Christian in society. In prison, it's the most difficult thing to do because the moment you wake up, you brushing your teeth, guys right there to see how you're going to respond to every little thing.
They test you.
Oh, yeah, all day long. And so it's a battle. And so you talking about a person like me who I think when I went to Angola, I had this, that was 2002. I had been a Christian at that time. I went in 2005, about five, almost 3 years, right? And so I still was cussing, you know. I still cuss you out. We play basketball. Look, I'm going to cuss you out. If you foul me, it's going to come out there. Now, I had some other things in my life that I had intact, but they still had some little issues. And so I get there. Now you're going to be really tested, right? Because there's some people that may know you and some people who don't. It's different when you're at a facility that for years that guys wouldn't test you because they actually knew you. Now you go to another place, I don't know you, right? But you say you're a man of God, mm-hmm. right? And so it's a different test. Hey, brother, can you give me a soup? That's one of the famous tests for a believer. They come up asking you for something, right? And so the moment you don't give it to them, guess what's going to happen? Fake Christian.
Yep.
Knew it all the time, man. You ain't no believer. And so that's the life I was dived
God
off
was
into.
Passing out loaves of bread and wine.
Oh, yeah. And you can't give me a soup, brother. So, you know, it's all kind of stuff that happens. But seminary, man, was dope. It actually taught me a lot of stuff that I actually applied. I was one of those guys. I got in there. I said, you know what? This is eventually I'm going to get out. And so every day they probably called me a false prophet because in my mind, I believe, man, if God could do that in my life, I can get out of here any moment, right? So I was there. I kept saying it. I'll be gone soon. I'm probably going to finish school out there. And 5 years passed. I'm still in the penitentiary, you know what I'm saying? And so, but that time, I took school like, look, when I get out of here, this is the stuff I'm going to do. I'm going to do. So I involved myself in every program, everything that was connected to the things I felt I was going to be doing when I got out. And so if it was Malachi Dash, because we started Malachi, I don't know if you had.
Yeah, I was in. Chris Pendleton was my educator.
Yeah, so yeah.
My boy.
Yeah, you talking about, yeah, my main man. Penn. So me and Penn was actually in my group. We started, it was five guys that started Malachi Dash. Me, George, Gillum, Keith Moores, God bless that brother, man. We got one guy that's still in prison, Randy Finch. And so Ronnie Olivier, who's the chaplain in Mississippi right now, all of us started Malachi Dads together in 2006. And our first graduation was 2007. And so it took off like wildfire. Five young guys started an organization about kids, you know, being a father inside of prison. So we took that off, and it was just everything I did, one thing out of another. I knew that's the stuff I was going to be into. So I took it serious. Y'all ain't asking the question. Y'all just want me to run this.
No, I'm enjoying it, man. You're I can tell you this, related to Malachi Dads, I learned a lot, man. Before I went to prison, I had my oldest son, who's now 17, and I was his dad, but I was a kid with a kid. Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I was financially there, and I would pick him up and bring him to Hooters. Yeah. Pick up women with me.
Yeah, that's all you knew. You was a boy.
I didn't know how to be a dad. And so, you know, I loved him. And I knew that I loved him. And but I was so worried about myself. And I was selfish. And I didn't care. I didn't care about myself. So I couldn't possibly effectively take care of another human.
Yeah.
And so being a part of that program, you know, you got a lot of guys that have already raised kids.
Yeah.
You know, you got older dudes in there, and that was valuable for me because I was able to tell them, A, the guilt that I was going through for leaving, you know, Gavin whenever he was three, and then all the things that I was experiencing with him while I was there. And so they were able to give me practical advice, you know what I mean? Stuff like, hey, look, I done did this. Guys that have been back and forth to prison, and they gave me the game. And I was always thankful for that. And the cool part about it was the Christian twist on it, the godly principles, which helped out tremendously, you know what I mean? And then I don't know if you were there, but they started doing, like, events. So, like, around Christmas or certain holidays or whatever, you could have your kids come up and give them gifts and do this and do that. And if you were part of Malachi Dad, you got to participate in that. And I was very thankful for that.
Yeah, we made a lot of breakthroughs. Look, that's a little sensitive spot for me. I'm talking about Malachi Dads because I still feel like they robbed us. But
what they do? What happened?
Well, you know, it's simple. You know, in prison, sometimes you get exploited. It was five of us who actually did the hard work, and Malachi Dads is everywhere. And so they wound up one time trying to rewrite the story. And it was two organizations, nonprofit organizations that had Malachi Dads that helped us, was our sponsors. One was Awana, the other one is Lifeline. And so, you know, that was a little, you know, situation that we had to deal with, you know, because I think for the most part, them people thought we was never getting out. You know, I never had a life sentence, but they thought everybody that was there was never going to get out. And so they put it everywhere. When we get out, it's basically like, hey, that's y'all did in there, but we have it out here. But just speaking on Malachi Dads, man, when I was in there, I had that problem. You know, my son was 3 years old. And so one of my issues was not only guilt, but not wanting to see him be in the same situation I was. Because my father and my grandfather, we all had the same name. So my grandfather was killed by the police, and my father was killed. And so I knew, and all of them had trouble with crime in prison. And so I was in there, I was like, man, I don't want my son to actually fall in this situation. I left him. And so when at the time, God placed it where everybody who was together in that group, Ron Olivier, Randy Finch, Keith Moores, the only one that didn't have a child was George Gillum. And so we all got together and we said, you know what, we're going to be passionate. It's also Mr. Lyndon the Schooner. He worked for Awana. But he used to come in and we had to figure out, man, how can we still be fathers and make a godly impact while our kids don't come to prison? That's what it started about. We didn't want our kids to come down the same cycle of crime. And so that was so important, man, for myself, that we find a way how to still be a father or become a father. Because like you said, most of us, especially myself, I felt like I wasn't a father. I was, you know, I did the same thing. I wanted my son to be a man. That's all I knew. I'm going to be a little man, you know, doing little, you know, little stuff like that. Bring him to Hooters or boy, touch that little girl, rub her titty, you know, something like that, just to make sure you're a man. So, but that wasn't being a father. You know, being a provider is something that, you know, most of us was good at because we made sure we gave money. Now, some people even doing that. And so we had to figure out, man, what's a real father, right? And so we started looking at different curriculums. I think, you know, I don't know when you took it, but it became watered down later on. But we had some serious curriculum. One, to be a real father was that you had to have a relationship with God. I think about all the time that a man who don't have a relationship with God, you can't be a real father because God is your father, whether people like that statement or not. And so if you don't have a connection with your own real father, which is God, and you don't even have no kind of moral compass that comes from him, you can't be a father, right? Because there's going to be some things that you're going to do is going to be very selfish, like go to prison, right? Like this doing things that don't consider the kid, that considers yourself. And so that was one of the things we wanted to do. So we picked Experience of God. So that stayed there for a while, for a long time. They changed it. But Experience of God was a good book because it actually, no matter who you was, it taught you seven basic principles about having a relationship with God. And matter of fact, you could use it across the board. It wouldn't have to be a Christian, but that book taught you principles about God. And so the next thing we did was with the practical side, which we wrestled with it because we had to use a secular book. At first, it was Inside Out Dads. Remember that workbook? So that book was a book that taught you how to relate to your kid while you're in prison, right? And so we'll sit in a small group, and you'll get that wisdom for certain people who had been in prison before, but they're still communicating with their kids and had did certain things with their kids and was real fathers, but they just happened to come to prison for a mistake. And so you sitting there gleaning all the information, and we set that course up. And so we had that curriculum. We also had a curriculum called Family Man, Family Leader, where we identified what happened, what was the breakdown in families. I don't know if you ever had that book.
I don't think
and so. And I think it was 1816. I might be quoting the date wrong, but it was at one time the father was not only just a provider, but he was a teacher, right? He taught the kids were taught in the home. And so what happened was the railroad industry came in effect. And so the fathers were basically snatched out the homes all at one time. Now, a lot of people we walk around don't know that fathers were actually the school teachers. There was the nurturers in the home, not just the one that goes and every day goes to work and come back and all he does is put the money on the table. No, he be a dad. He was the one that he took you to school. He was actually your teacher. He was the one that nurtured you until that time. And in America, people don't even think about that no more because I didn't even. It's not a black thing or a white thing. When the railroads hit, all the men was taken out of the home. So children were actually back then was reared with two people in the home, but the father was the main factor, right? And so when you look around now, we don't have fathers. And so sometimes, you know, you need to go back to history. So we use that book to show you that, look, it's not just about prison. It's the fact that the whole culture had changed when this happened. and it was real important. So
what was the name of that book again?
He gonna try to get the book. That's the only question you ask. It must have touched you all. Family man, family leader.
Family man.
I still jokes, man. So I still clown people. So don't,
that's good,
don't get messed up, man.
I'm
so,
here for it.
It's a good book. He talks a lot about history, or a lot about what a father looks like. You know, because a father is not only supposed to just, like I said, provide. He's supposed to be the priest of the family. He's supposed to be the king. When you talk about being the king of your own house, you know, we all say that, right? Well, being a king means that you make the godly decision, that you rule and you direct people.
Right.
So a kingdom, if you just think about a kingdom, leader. Kingdom has a purpose. So a king is the one that decides the purpose of that kingdom, where the kingdom is actually going. You know how we see these movies and they say, well, they hadn't had a war in 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's because of the affairs of the kingdom. The king has been keeping all his affairs right. Well, he probably, if you ain't had war in 5 years, that means you've been negotiating. Mm-hmm. You made great friends. You had strategized where people are not, they're afraid to attack you. And so a father is like a king in his own home. And so family man, family leader brings that out. We talk about being the king of your home, being the priest of your home, and also just being the provider. So all that stuff is in the book, and it talks about the history of it. So if you ever go read it, it's a good book.
You can click on the link below.
All right, click on the link below.
Hey, what year did you get released?
So I got released in 2018.
Okay.
October 5th.
So tell me this. What was your greatest challenge coming home? Entering a new society that you haven't been in, 25 years? 25 years. And then how did society treat you?
Different.
Well, what did it feel like right whenever you got out? Was it like how the movies say, whenever the doors just open, it goes from dark just to sunlight, you can breathe the fresh air, you cried a little bit, you were levitating? What it feel like on that day?
I can't even describe it. I was so happy, too happy. I mean.
Did you cry? I did. Listen, I cried like.
Cry. I don't think that's a cry. You know, I don't want to cry when you can't even breathe.
That's how I did. I didn't even make it out. When they go, clack, and I looked at my grandpa, and I hit the sunlight hit me, and a gust of wind hit me, and I saw birds. I don't know if I saw that. I'm just painting the scene here. But when I felt the air hit me.
Like a Disney movie.
I was.
Yeah, so crying ain't the word, man. I'm talking about, I left. I got out of prison, and my whole, while I was in there, I said, I want to go straight to the beach. I want to wake up and thank God in front of an ocean.
So
that's what I did. I left and I went straight to Miami. I got out. I went straight to Miami because they give you 72 hours to check in.
Yeah.
I'll be slick. You got 72 hours. So I got released on a Friday, right? So I was supposed to get released on a Thursday at 12:01. They don't do that no more. So I came out of work release. And the people know I was excited and happy at the same time. Because when the 12:01 hit, I wrapped my mat up and stood by the door. I'm not going nowhere. Time is over with. That's a wrap. It's over. So when I got out, I went straight there, man. I woke up on the morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning. Was the only one out there on the beach. Just sitting there like, man.
Free.
Free. All right? It wasn't until I actually got back home that the reality struck in. You're free, and now you need a job. You need this. You need that. And this monster right here.
Yeah.
Is because you got to realize when I left the street, applications was on. You had to go in there and you had to fill it out.
Right?
And so I had a job. You know, I was actually working because I was in a work release.
Yeah.
And so now I'm free and I'm dealing with this for everything. I'm dealing with the technology situation. And look, that was the biggest headache because, you know, in prison, you know, you have to messing with this right here. You might don't come home messing with a cell phone, you know, whatever they might call it. It was an issue because you gotta try to work it. I finally got an iPhone. My pastor said I just finally got saved, but I had an Android, right? So my salvation was based on the phone.
Welcome to the light.
The light. That's what he'll say. So y'all might have the same belief system.
Yeah.
So that was a problem, and also is, and I think most people don't talk about this, is when I was in prison, I lost a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting out, in reality struck, I lost my mom and my dad. It's like,
okay. Through death. So you were,
so your support system wasn't all the way there.
So, and then and it's also getting out, and the rest of your family looking at them like, I ain't seen you in 20 years, man. Like, how you want me to feel? You know, yeah. And that's, in essence, it's like, oh, even though I'm a believer, it's like, I haven't actually talked to you in 20 years.
You ain't write me. So you ain't like, send me no money. So it's you just, ain't yeah. send no word through nobody. Nothing.
You know, you just vanished.
You left it's me.
A stranger.
Yeah.
Even though I put myself in here, I'm still a little salty that we was tight now, and then when I left,
so you got to deal with all that. You know, you got to deal. Because, like, that's the biggest thing. I know what I did. But it's just like, bam, okay. You still had to leave? I didn't do you anything. You know, so, you know, that was a difficult moment. But for the most part, I'm going to tell you something. I ain't had no difficult days since I've been out here. Because I think for me, I prayed to get out. Mm-hmm. I prayed to get out of here. And so I told it to somebody last night. I said, look, bad days, I smiled at them because I asked to be out here. I asked to pay bills. Yeah. I asked to have conflict with family. I asked to hear my son tell me something stupid. And it's like, I asked for that. I asked to go cut my grass. I asked to ask to pay for these doggone bills.
Yeah.
That's what I spent 20-something years praying to get out of prison. All right, so when I get out and you got problems, and I'm like, all right, come on with them. Because I knew when I was in prison, I didn't have problems. You know, I had misery. That's how I feel. That's how I feel. I can't talk about how everybody else may feel about.
I concur.
So difficulties out here for some people, to me, is not difficult. It's man. Thank God that I got to figure out how to pay these bills, right? That's how I look at it. I got to figure out how to make this relationship work.
You're thankful.
It's that for me because even in marriage, I'm married. So I got married soon. I got and people. Oh man, you got married soon. You got well.
Hey, I did too.
Soon I got a jail. I'm married. Right, October 6th. I got October 5th. October 6th. He said, "You know, this did it. It hasn't been an easy thing, but guess what?
Every he wanted a conjugal visit.
Yeah, that's all. So I ain't want no conjugal visit, but that's what it probably sound like, right? So
I'm just messing.
All that stuff that I know people look at. Marriage is a problem to some people, right? In reality, marriage is real. But guess what? Even in my difficulty, I say, hey, man, I'm on this side. Right, I'm free. And so it's not a problem. I might get mad in a moment, but it's not. Because I prayed to get out. I prayed to be a part of this life. So that's how I look at stuff that happened. That's me personally. I can't speak for nobody else.
I like that.
And so when you ask me that, it's kind of like, did I really have difficult days? Nah. Man, I'm going to tell you right now. I got out, and I came back, and I was going to work. I ran out of gas. Because the truck I was in, it was one of those trucks that didn't have no gas meter. I stopped on the exit, ran out. I could have lost my life, like, and I had been out a whole month. They had a car coming full speed and didn't see my blinker lights, right? Because that's what I had. I ain't had no new cars. I had a truck that somebody gave me. You know, my wife had gave me a truck. And so I'm thinking it got gas in it, right? And so I don't know to get out and, you know, make people know that, hey, I'm on this exit. I'm just sitting there chilling, trying to work the phone and say, hey, you know, I'm on this exit, you know, ain't never look up. When I look up at the last minute, they clip my window, they clip the rear view mirror. Uh-huh. And the man is tumbling, right? He's tumbling. He finally doesn't wreck, because he had a trailer on it too. Mm-hmm. So this is gonna be a situation. I'm on a ramp like this. Right? He's coming full speed on the exit. And he clipped it, barely touched it. And he went into a spin. Just me and him out there. We've been in other cars. This would have been a serious situation. I get out the car. The guy who seen it comes out. I have a smile on my face. They sitting there tripping because I'm smiling. Like, you realize what you... I said, man, another blessing, man. He going to let me enjoy my freedom, right? And so the man like, man, you ain't panicking because most people probably been on there. Man, damn, ran out of gas. I'm sitting there like, I hope I got a gas can. And the dude is like, bro, you all right? I said, man, I ain't going to tell him, you know, because I feel like, well, I don't want nobody to know. I just kind of chill, man. I'm knocked up.
I'm good.
I've been in the cage for, you know, 20-something years.
I'm going to be blessed to walk this mile to get this gas.
And look, so that's all I'm saying. I said, well, I could walk straight down here. So the dude like, no, man, you can't do that. Because I'm about to walk down there with the can to get the gas, right? So the dude like, man, I'm going to go get it for you. And it's just chill out. So I was going to walk straight down that ramp with a smile and come back. And I could think about that. I bring that situation out because most people that have been like, oh hell, this is the worst. This right here messed my whole day up.
Yeah.
I come back and my wife's like, you actually did that? I said, yeah. So I was gonna walk down there and she kind of was messed, kind of shook and like, boy, you said you ran out of gas? Like, yeah, I ran out of gas. It's a new experience. Guess what? I ain't never ran out of gas before. It's something new. Right, and so it's stuff like that.
This is what they talk about. Yeah, go get some gas.
So I mean, you'll hear Ron say, and then he, you know, Ron Olivia, he'll say, getting stuck in traffic He said, man, his wife was going off, heated. He was sitting there laughing. Never been in a traffic jam. Right? So
you first experience.
So this is my first experience. He's sitting there laughing like, hey, this is good.
Yeah, you know
now nowadays
take for granted this stuff.
Oh yeah.
Because I can tell you right now when you're dislocated into a new environment where all of these things that we consider to be pains in the ass or a burden or whatever we consider it as that, you'll get the thing like, man, I wish I could be in that.
Oh yeah.
I had a lot of experiences like that. So look, tell us about what you're doing now.
So, can we skip over a lot, but I'm gonna tell you about, I'm doing some exciting stuff. I was blessed to get an opportunity to go into a place that I came out of, and now to mold and shape how people be released from prison. And so what I'm able to do at this point is do stuff like this, Scott. I could look at an individual and say, okay, you came to prison because you was a drug addict, and so that's the worst thing you did in your life. I'm about to set you on course to get out of here, and I'm going to deal with your habit, but I'm also make sure you never have to come back to prison. So in a nutshell, that's what I do. So my whole mindset is, even though I'm the program director, I develop programs based on what I know you need to not come back to prison, right? And I always think about when I was in prison, I was hoping that that's what people do. Like, we had a person that we met, we all know Warden Cook. Warden Cook never sat in our seat, but his mindset was, I want to make sure I give you everything you need to be successful when you get out.
Yep.
And so I go at my job like that every day. And so I'm fighting a battle because the place we went into, that's not their mindset. Their mindset is lock them up, make them stay in, and that's it. Right?
And you work for the Mississippi Department of Corrections.
Yeah, I work for the Mississippi Department of Corrections. I know it's probably hard for me to say that, but that was the mindset 5 years ago. Right?
I ain't messed up with it. I think in order to effect change, you're going to have to hire us.
Yeah, that's true.
Facts.
So right now I go to work every day and trying to strategize how to make sure guys are, because the prison I'm at right now has men, women, and children, right? So it's a lot of moving parts. So every day I come to work and basically try to develop programs and educational programs to make sure those individuals don't ever come back to prison, right? And it's not an easy job because, again, you have different views. Some people believe when a person commits a crime, they should just be punished, right? Well, that's your view until they get out and they commit another crime and they kill one of your relatives,
right?
So if you want to foster anger and bitterness, that's what you want to do, just know, then this. When I say that, sometimes people get offended, but that's the truth because you got some people go to jail for selling rocks or selling crack, and when they come out, now they're murderers because they've been treated so harsh in prison. And so I know that because I sat there. I watched it. I watched people come to prison. And they made one mistake, and that mistake is gonna allow people that's in prison that work there to abuse them, right? Instead of actually treat them like human beings, so they don't come back. So when you go to prison, what happens is they try to take your identity. The first thing they do is give you a DOC number, right? And so my job, while I'm doing this job, you know what I do? Everybody, I call them a resident. I'll call them by their name.
Right.
Right. And so I say this to them all the time.
Instead of
inmate.
Instead of offender. Instead of convict. Instead of prisoner.
And so it's so difficult because, you know, I'm doing a job and you got some people then brought into that. Inmates themselves. They're like, they feel like I'm an inmate. Mm-hmm. Right? And so when you're dealing with them, you're dealing with that. But again, just to let you know what I do every day. So I supervise the education department, the chaplain department. Anything that deals with programs, right? I supervise, but I also develop and implement programs, new programs. And so when I got there, they didn't have a lot of programs, period. And so they call it up there in Mississippi, they call it the Angola system, right? Because that's what they know. Well, the difference is I didn't do all my time in Angola. Right? I did my time everywhere else. I was when I was in prison, I went from different facilities. And so when I look at a facility, I know you can't fit the stuff in Angola there. And so I just lay it out. I get on the board, and I think about everybody that's there. So if I got half of my prisoners there, 65% of them, they're drug addicts. So what I need to do is I need to find out what can I do to stop them from being on drugs. Then what can I give them, sustain them so they can have a great income that they'll never be tempted to go back to prison, right? Because most people, they own drugs or they selling drugs, and it's a reason. And so then you have violent crime. That's another thing that you have to deal with. So I deal with that. And I use stuff like anger management, stuff that we had, Celebrate Recovery, Malachi Dads. So I just put all that stuff in prison. But the difference is I'm actually active every day.
Yep.
And so I'm one of the guys they see every day. So like
a right relatable now, face.
So I go down, I go in the program and teach with them. So culinary school, for instance, I started culinary school by force. So a lot of the stuff I'm doing, it's not accepted because they don't really want no stuff there. So I run a culinary school like it's a restaurant.
Who's they? They don't want it. Higher ups?
Yeah.
The powers that be?
When I say they, there are people that come to prison, that work at prison, and they come there for one reason, to make another person miserable.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
And so, but my job is more difficult because, you know, I come from Louisiana. So Mississippi has its own culture. And so you got a lot of people that's been working there already in Mississippi. And that's they've been doing, and it's anywhere you go, people don't like change. And I said this one day when the commissioner was talking, I said, one of the problems is when we come in, they think it's by force. And I said, so what I did, because when I first got there, when I first took the job, it's like, man, it's like trying to move. This and this stuck. No one go nowhere. And I said, you know what? I don't know what I'm going to do. So I got on the board, and I wrote two words, here and there. And I said, look, I'm going to put every department that's in the program department, the chaplain department, vocation department, I put all their names there. And I said, I want y'all to show me what y'all did the last 5 years. And then I want you to grade yourself from that last 5 years. So one of the things that happened, the vocation department got up there. They didn't have a vocational school, but it was a vocation department. Nothing active, right? So they had to get up there and give a fat zero, the chaplain department. Only thing you ever did is give death messages. That's it. And marriages.
Death, oh yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So when a family member dies, you know, yeah. I used to do that.
Call, yeah.
So I said, this is all you produce, right? So lay it out there. Our GED schools. How many people have got their GED? Pre-release, right? Pre-release had at the time, and you know about this, pre-release at the time is 4 to 5 hours. That's all it is to finish pre-release. They took 2 years for 14 people. So they put it up there. We got a population of, our population now is almost at 4,000. And so I made them put it up there. And next thing I did, I said, okay, this is what we are trying to do. So I laid out everything that we wanted to do. And so I got this model, and they told me I need to have it copyrighted. Got an 8-step system. Reentry starts at the top because I believe when you go to prison, because this is one of the things when I was in, I always thought about going home all day long. And so if you start them off pointing them to back, to going to back in society, it gets them off this mindset, I don't belong here. So I'm only here to get what I need to get out.
Right? Guest.
Huh?
You're a guest.
That's it.
Not a
permanent resident. Yeah. This is not your residence right here. So the next thing is treatment. So I have 8 steps. Reentry is the top. The next step is treatment. So treatment is where I find out where you at. That's where I'm going to find out if you got an education. So unlike what they did when I first got in, if you take a TABE test and they say 2.2, that's your second grade level, they instead of kicking you out. No, when I see that, guess what? I automatically know I need to put you in school. I need to figure out how to get, if you can't learn, that's one thing. But if you can, I'm going to figure it out. The next thing, I need to find out if you have any type of religious background. So treatment, it does all that stuff when you first come, right? So I developed this referral sheet that I got. I stole this right here when I was working at Total Community Action in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So as a case manager down there, they do a lot of referrals. You need food stamp, they're gonna send you a referral to the food stamp department. Right. You need housing, they're going to send you that. So I developed this form, right? So when you come in, as soon as you come in, all the case manager had to do is say, okay, they call them classification. But all they have to do is check off the box. He needs a GED. He needs to be put in celebrate recovery. He needs a trade. He needs this. He needs this. And it's all on one checklist, right?
Right.
And so all of our programs are on one checklist. And so that's in treatment. The next thing we have, that's right there, is education, vocational. A slide, we have the clubs. I don't know if you know anything about the clubs. So we got clubs. So teaching them about how to have your own organization. Mm-hmm. And I deal with recreation because I'm over that too. So keeping yourself healthy in prison, right?
You run everything at that place.
Figured it out. And so then you have the chapel department. So the chapel slash chapels, that's on the programs too. And it ends at reentry. So it's 8 steps, right? So I'm gonna touch you everywhere you're at.
That's so magnificent,
that's
man.
That's what I do.
I'm going to tell you.
Fill those buckets.
That's pretty impressive, man. Yeah. We're running out of time. I think the camera's about to, the battery's about to die, too. But, George, I'm thoroughly impressed with what you got going on in Mississippi. Like I said, I've been talking for years about formerly incarcerated people running prisons, and that's what you're doing. And I really hope that permeates to the rest of the country and the systems that we have, because in my opinion, which I think I'm right, that's the only way we're actually going to get rehabilitation in prison.
Yes, sir.
And I'm super proud of you. Keep up the good work. I can't wait to come over there and talk to the guys.
Yeah.
We'll do that soon. Thank you for coming.
And yeah, thank you.
You got
for your
any
time.
Organizations you want to plug while you're on here that you're involved in or you want people to know about?
I always talk about, you know, I'm going to talk about the church, man. That's my main source for a lot of guys. River Church, that's an organization that
where's it at?
It's on West Bank Expressway, 2414 West Bank Expressway in Harvey.
Check them out.
All right, go check them out.
All right, buddy. I appreciate you.